Greg Malloy here. Thanks for tuning in. You need to have pencil and paper a little bit later in this hour. Thanks to Sheila Samples again from Op-Ed News. Something important that you need to know, how to delete your Google browsing history before the new policy goes into effect. And it's coming the first. Boy, every time you turn around, it's something else, right? Huh? So stick around. This hour is sponsored by Bill in Paso Robles, California. A frequent contributor, email contributor. He writes a lot to the program. Thanks, Bill. His message, Mike and Kathy, what you deliver night after night is immeasurable and priceless. Deepest thanks, Bill in Paso Robles, California. Thank you very much, Bill. It's very kind. Appreciate it. I have to mention it. Davy Jones of the Monkees died today, age of 66. Apparently a heart attack at his home this morning. Taken to the hospital, pronounced dead. Peter Tork, his Monkees bandmate, released the following statement via Facebook. Quote, it is with great sadness that I reflect on the sudden passing of my longtime friend and fellow adventurer, David Jones. His talent will be much missed. His gifts will be with us always. My deepest sympathy to Jessica and the rest of his family. Adios to the Manchester Cowboy. Peace and love, Peter T. Something, just a little trivia thing that you may or may not know. Davy Jones, of course, was... he had a professional acting career when he was a kid, and... when he was 18 years old, he appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show to perform as part of the musical Oliver. That happened to be the same episode of the Ed Sullivan Show as the Beatles' legendary debut concert in this country. Davy Jones. You know, say what you like about that music. It... And I realize Bobby Hart and who was the other one? Bobby Hart and I forget the other songwriter. They wrote all the music. I don't think the Monkees at the beginning ever wrote anything. But in the late, mid to late 60s, they produced a sound that is definitely from that era. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot. Maybe you did too. And you just won't admit it, right? London's Occupy protesters were moved out in a midnight operation. About 50 tents moved. The High Court in London last week had allowed or ordered the eviction. And St. Paul's Cathedral, where Occupy protesters had pretty much encamped around that area, St. Paul, a spokesman for St. Paul's Cathedral, called the tearing down of the tents and the removal of these Occupy protesters a sad day for the church. Indeed. About 20 arrests were made. The land on which the tents were put up were owned by the City of London Corporation. They do things a little bit differently. Their bailiffs employed by the civic authority got the tents removed in an hour-long operation. That's how they do it. They don't send out deputies or sheriffs or... They send bailiffs. The tents, of course, had come up in October, inspired by the same movement in this country against corporate greed and economic inequality. The City of London Corporation said it regretted, their word, that it had become necessary to evict the protesters. Regretted? And the eviction followed the High Court ruling last week that removing the camp was, quote, lawful and justified, end quote. George Barta, one of the five protesters who had appealed against the High Court's decision, was quoted by the BBC as saying, quote, it's not the beginning of the end, it's the end of the beginning. So, Occupy London protesters forcibly removed from their site, as is happening in this country a lot. Thank you. We have a report card from Kate Petrini that I want to share with you here a little bit later. She gave her U.S. history students an assignment based on Newt Gingrich's remarks regarding children working as janitors. And she sent me some of the replies from the kids in her class. She teaches, of course, at a parochial school in San Francisco. I'll share that with you a little bit later. A new study, rich people are more likely to lie and cheat. Why do you think they got rich, right? According to CNBC, there's a new study by the University of California, Berkeley, pretty much confirming what Occupy protesters have been saying, that the ethics of the rich are just crap, garbage. They lie, they cheat, they steal, they do anything necessary to continue to build up their pile of green pieces of paper. According to the study, upper class people are more likely to lie, cheat, endorse unethical workplace behavior, and even to cut others off when driving. According to the study, they're just total bastards. That's all. Volunteers who took part in the study reported their social class using the MacArthur scale of subjective socioeconomic status and filled out surveys revealing their attitudes about behavior and greed. Drivers from the upper class are four times as likely as other drivers to cut off other vehicles at a busy four-way intersection, three times more likely to cut off a pedestrian. And the chances of their agreeing with the old Gordon Gekko maxim from the movie Wall Street that greed is good are much higher. The study also showed that the super rich are more likely to literally take candy from a baby. Participants were in a laboratory with a jar of candy kept for visiting children and were offered the jar, whereupon the wealthier members of the study took twice as many. They were also more likely to deceive job candidates who they were recruiting for a job which would shortly be eliminated. Nice, huh? A doctoral student in psychology at UC Berkeley, lead author of the paper, said in a statement, quote, "The increased unethical tendencies of upper-class individuals are driven in part by their more favorable attitudes toward greed." He went on to say, "Mrump, these findings have very clear implications for how increased wealth and status in society shapes patterns of ethical behavior and suggests that the different social classes of social values among the haves and have-nots help drive these tendencies." Boo! Well, that's certainly a news flash, isn't it? That the rich are different from you and me. This guy obviously listens to Glenn Beck's radio program. Adrian Klein, he's 43 years old from Brighton, Colorado. He's an embalmer, and he's accused of stealing gold teeth from corpses and then pawning them for cash. According to Longmont, Colorado newspaper, pawnbrokers in that city noticed that the Beck fan, Adrian Klein, was frequently bringing in dental gold and thought it was creepy and weird. You see, prior to embalming, Klein, while he's listening to Glenn Beck, is suspected of removing gold crowns from the bodies, and then after cremation, Klein is suspected of removing dental gold from the remains. He would then allegedly take the gold to pawn shops to sell while he whistles along with Glenn Beck. A Boulder grand jury indicted Klein on suspicion of 8 counts of providing false information to a pawnbroker and 2 counts of providing false information to a second-hand dealer, and 3 counts of being a total ass and listening to Glenn Beck while he rips the teeth out of corpses. Wow. You know, Glenn Beck listeners will stop at nothing. Just nothing. I mean, it's incredible. Police say that from May through November of 2011, Klein made 17 sales at various locations of other people's teeth, corpses' teeth, that added up to nearly $4,000. We'll be right back.
Oh, I officer sings. The 6 o'clock alarm would never ring. But it rings and I rise, wipe the sleep out of my eyes. My shaven razor's cold and it stings.
Bubblegum, right? But and thanks to Barb, it was Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart who wrote Monkey Music. Davy Jones died today, age 66, of a heart attack. A growing number of Americans can't find or can't afford food. Now, Prairie 2, whom we'll hear from a little bit later tonight with this report, has been warning about this for a long time. But it was at Huffington Post. The report comes to Food Research and Action Center, a nonprofit research group. And according to their findings, more Americans said they struggled to buy food in 2011 than in any year since the financial crisis. About 19% of people, almost one out of every five, told the Gallup pollsters who took this survey that they couldn't always afford to feed everyone in their family in 2011. Now, you can make the assumption that number got smaller, wrapped up with the national unemployment rate falling for several consecutive months, as it has here. But actually, the reverse has proved true. The number of people who said they couldn't afford food just keeps rising. And the findings from the Food Research and Action Center highlight what many people already know. The economic recovery, in theory, now more than 2 years old, has done little to keep millions of Americans out of poverty. And as Huffington Post reports, that incomes for many haven't kept pace with the cost of living. And for a large part of the country, things today are as bad as ever, or worse. 46 million Americans lived below the poverty line as of 2010, a record number, according to the Census Bureau. And that's not as high as some other estimates have put it. And as HuffPo puts it, take a further step back, and the situation appears even more dire. About 45% of people in the U.S. have reported not being able to cover their basic living expenses, including food, shelter, and transportation, according to the group Wider Opportunities for Women. Now, the official poverty rate in this country is about 15%, but over two-fifths, 40% of Americans, have so little saved that one financial emergency is all it would take to put them in poverty. That's according to the Corporation for Enterprise Development. As for widespread hunger of the kind recorded by the study, research shows that the entire country ends up paying one way or another. Well, the people who can't afford food are obviously suffering the worst. The social costs incurred from the money spent to keep food pantries open to the lifelong diminished earning power of impoverished children. Well, if you got to put a dollar or figure on it, it comes to about $167 billion a year, or $542 for every man, woman, and country, or a child in the country. Land of the free, land of opportunity, home of the brave, the greatest country on earth. Hey, hey, hey. The mythology just continues, doesn't it? Huh? It just continues. I mean, every day if you have a job, you get up, go to work. If you have to ride the expressways, the freeways, interstates in your part of the country, man, it's just chock-a-block with cars. How could anything be going wrong? There's nothing going wrong. How could anything be going wrong with all the cars on the expressway? We're all going to work, right? Right? One of the mysteries of the universe, right? Okay, stick around. When we come back, it's going to be either a Prairie 2 or Cape Petrini. We'll have a conference here during the break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
I saw her face. Now I'm a believer. Not a trace doubt in my mind. I'm in love. I'm a believer. I couldn't leave her if I
tried. Before the hour. This hour is being sponsored by Bill in Paso Robles, California. Thanks, Bill. His message, Mike and Kathy, we deliver night after night, is immeasurable and priceless. Deepest thanks, Bill in Paso Robles. That's very kind. Thank you, Bill. Thank you for the sponsorship. Kate Petrini is a school teacher in San Francisco. She's our education affairs correspondent. She sends this. Hi, Mike. Last week, I gave my U.S. history students the following assignment based on Newt Gingrich's remarks regarding children working as janitors. Here's the assignment. Quote, you say to somebody, you shouldn't go to work before you're 14 or 16 years of age. Fine, you're totally poor. You're in a school that is failing with a teacher that is failing. I've tried for years to have a very simple model. Most of these schools ought to get rid of the unionized janitors, have one master janitor, and pay local students to take care of the school. The kids would actually do work. They would have cash. They would have pride in the school. They'd begin the process of rising. Really poor children in really poor neighborhoods have no habits of working and have nobody around them who works, so they have no habit of showing up on Monday. End quote. Newt Gingrich, former Speaker of the U.S. House and current presidential candidate. After watching the video clip and reading Mr. Gingrich's comments, students write a 1-2 paragraph thoughtful letter to him in which you respond to his proposal that children work as janitors. Use specific information from our unit on industrialism and the Gilded Age to back up your arguments. All right, that was Kay's assignment. Here are some excerpts from her students' letters. And she adds, I'm proud of them. Here's the first one. Your proposal that children should work as janitors was very ignorant and shocking. Don't you know anything about the history of industrialism and the Gilded Age? Impoverished children and their families had to work in terribly dangerous, low-paying jobs for extremely long hours. They had to live in tenements where there was squalor, overcrowding, disease, and no sanitation. So your comments about how, quote, really poor children in really poor neighborhoods have no habits of working and nobody around to make them around them who works, end quote, could not be further from the truth. Please do your research before you make statements to the public, Mr. Gingrich. Next one. How many hours would the students work? Would they receive breaks? Would they get minimum wage? Is there coverage or protection if the child gets injured on the job? I hope that nothing would happen like what happened in the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory. Next. I believe your proposal was wrong and made no sense. You said, quote, really poor children have nobody around them who works, end quote. However, just because you are poor does not mean you don't know how, you don't know anybody who works. Not everyone who is poor is out of work. They could be working but just receiving a low income. Next. I'm not sure you actually know what poor families experience. I disagree with you because many people that came to the United States at the turn of the last century all worked to make a living and support their families. Many of the children were not able to go to school because they had to help. However, once the progressives, capital P, became involved and saw the condition of the places where the kids worked, they took action. The progressives made it possible for children to go to school. And the next. You want to get rid of unionized janitors. Are you aware that unions benefit workers? They're extremely important because they help if you get sick or injured or unemployed. You need to be grateful for the things you have and help those who do not have the blessings you do, Mr. Gingrich. And the next. Obviously, you do not realize that one of the best things that President FDR ever did was pass the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938. What type of future can a working child have? Take a look at the pictures of children who worked during the industrialism and the Gilded Age, and you will see how these children's childhoods were taken from them. Next. Back in the day, the working conditions of children were horrifying. Some examples are that they were not paid a lot, they could not use the bathrooms while they worked, and if they got injured, they were either fired or had to keep working with their injured body part. Is this really what you want for the children of our future? Next. Poor children already go through so much stress, and to make them work more than they already do is a horrible idea. Going to school provides them a break from their difficult and stressful lives. It's a place where they can feel safe and where they pursue their hopes of a better future. Poor children need education to advance themselves. They don't need more work. And then Kay adds, at the end of this reading, these amazing letters makes me think that maybe, just maybe, what I do for a living matters, at least today. Kay. And you can read more about this. Go to her website, kaysreportcard.com. kaysreportcard.com. And a P.S. Mike, this week at school, I'm teaching a class on foreign films. This is part of a program of alternative classes that we do every other year. Monday's selection was an outstanding film entitled Paradise Now, which follows two young men on the West Bank after they are recruited to be suicide bombers. If you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it. It was necessary for me to give my class an introduction to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict before the movie because their knowledge of the subject was almost non-existent. Mike, you often talk about the line that the American government toes in dealing with Israel and how the media parrot that strictly pro-Israel viewpoint. After Monday's lesson, it was clear to me that the rules, quote-quote, which have been established by those two entities have had a profound effect on me. As I led the classroom discussion, I found myself anxious, overly cautious, and very uncomfortable. I was very careful to not cross any line for fear that I would have angry parents to deal with, if you know what I mean. Ultimately, I did the best I could, and I believe the kids now have a basic understanding of the intractable Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But when I think about how I felt teaching the Middle Eastern material versus giving students the background of pre-Castro Cuba in preparation for yesterday's film, Chico and Rita, there's just no comparison. Just another indication of how strongly we Americans have been indoctrinated. Okay. Yeah, I get that feeling every time I bring up the Palestinian-Israeli issue for the past quarter century, even going back to the first Intifada in the early 80s when I was working at the very conservative Cox Communications-owned radio station WSB here in Atlanta, a 50,000-watt unrestricted channel that blasted out over about 35 states. And as an explorer I don't think I was a truth seeker at the time, more of an explorer going into the territory I had no idea about, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Because I had been, you know, I'd been inculcated with pretty much the same thing that most Americans had. I can remember I was in Raleigh, North Carolina during the 1967 war. And just in the Middle East, and just absolutely cheering on the Israelis, Moshe Dayan and the Israeli high command, who fought against four different Arab armies and beat them. And I can remember I had a lot of Jewish friends, still do, and just being in a real celebratory mood when it was apparent that Israel was just stomping the hell out of the enemies that surrounded their tiny little country. And it took about 15 or 20 years for me to once again revisit that topic. And when I did, in talking with American Jews, Palestinian Americans, people who had lived on kibbutzes in Israel, people who had come to this country from the occupied territories, from people who had witnessed Sabra and Shatila, the massacre there. I mean, listening to just about anyone I could listen to, and then all of a sudden it came clear that the Israeli government was treating the Palestinians in much the same way as the Hitler government treated the Jewish population prior to the use of trains to take people to the death camps. And when I came to that realization, it was horrifying to me. I mean, it was just horrifying that a people whose cause I had, in my little teeny inch of the universe, had always celebrated. I was a fan of the movie Exodus. I thought that was the real history of what happened with the establishment of the State of Israel. So, you know, and then the ensuing quarter century, after reading and paying attention, reading Israeli writers, Palestinian writers, Arab writers, Muslim writers, Jewish writers, American, blah, 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 blah. You know, until finally I just wanted to scream, why don't you people stop? You know, why can't you stop? So I know the feeling, Kay. Even now, I get this weird feeling when I bring up the topic, like, are you talking about something that you shouldn't be talking about? And when I get that feeling, I just kind of laugh.
I break my stone before the tempest to bring them.
For the hour, this hour has been sponsored by Bill in Paso Robles, California, and he is very kind in saying, Mike and Kathy, what you deliver night after night is immeasurable and priceless. Deepest thanks, Bill in Paso Robles, California. Thanks, Bill. Regarding food insecurity or people not being able to afford food, quick email from Bruce Enberg. He writes, not only do wages continue to decline and food constantly rise in price, although there was some downward pressure on food prior to the latest gas price spike, But also, food sources for the poor are drying up. Those who depend on food banks are finding as little as a quarter the amount of food that once was available. Relatives who might have been helping them in the past are now going hungry themselves. The increase in food stamps near the end of the Bush reign is not going as far as it did with rising prices. By the way, more people went on food stamps during the last 3 years of Bush than during the first 3 years of the so-called food stamp president, Obama. Median family income has fallen about $5,000 while everything else has gone up sharply. And the Occupy camps are being closed. That's a euphemism for being shut down by the authorities. Yeah, I got time here from Prairie 2. Bumper stickers. The Obama-Biden 2012 bumper sticker keeps getting longer. Among the Bush blunders reversed so far, Bin Laden dead, Iraq war over, GM number one again, North Korea nuke-free, North Korea needs the food badly, and a peace deal would give it the chance to really ramp itself up as the cheap labor factory floor for both China and South Korea. You could say that Obama is close to World War III with Iran, the corporate media says so, but there are rumors that just the opposite is true. Why would the axis of evil give up its nuclear, to quote George Bush, ambitions? Maybe they can deal with Obama and believe the Bush crime family is out of power permanently. Iran is being hurt pretty bad by the sanctions against its banks, but Obama has so far been unwilling to cut them off completely from the International Bank Clearinghouses, or Clearinghouse Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunications, or SWIFT, even though the banking hub has publicly agreed to do so in order to meet U.S. demands. Or more likely, the bankers, who are supposed to be non-political and neutral, are unwilling to back the U.S.'s play. If they do this, then China could demand the same be done against Taiwan. And China, unlike the U.S., is still a superpower. However, the United States is not declining quite as fast as previously thought, with fourth quarter GDP growth revised upward to 3%. This is respectable growth for a mature economy like the United States, mature in that it's dominated by old rich people who steal everything, at least where they can pull up the nails that are holding it to the floor. The stock market fell below 13,000 today on news that the Fed chairman doesn't believe more money printing is needed right now. The Dow doesn't really like good news, although Ben Bernanke did say unemployment would likely rise later in the year, and that did buoy Wall Street spirit somewhat. Job creation has actually been quite brisk, according to the households. Prairie 2 can get very sarcastic, can't he? Job creation has actually been quite brisk, according to the household survey, with a number of new jobs created on the order of 500,000 in two of the last 3 months. New February numbers will be out soon, and we'll be able to see if this is a real trend. Oil market analysts, the ones that don't work for Wall Street, are predicting that gasoline is more likely to be $3 by summer than $5. There's simply too much gasoline sloshing around. Supplies on hand are at record highs. Europe is slipping into recession on top of declining demand in the U.S., and this makes it almost a certainty that the speculation bubble will burst. That's the gasoline or oil speculation. But I hope the gas price goes way down so I can afford to drive something big enough to hold my Obama bumper sticker. PrairieNumeral2.com. He's an Obama supporter, in a manner of speaking. And also can be very sarcastic. I hate sarcasm, don't you? I mean, it just has no place on a radio show. All right, what do we got coming up? Oh, yeah, the WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks began publishing what it's referred to, not today, but 2 days ago, began publishing the Global Intelligence Files. That's more than 5 million emails from the Texas-headquartered so-called global intelligence company, Stratfor. I know you've been following this. Emails date from between July 2004 and late December just passed. They revealed the inner workings of a company, Stratfor, that fronts as an intelligence publisher, but actually provides confidential intelligence services to large corporations such as Bhopal, India's Dow Chemical Company, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, and government agencies, including Department of Homeland Security here, the United States Marines, and U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency. The emails show Stratford's web of informers, the payoff structure, payment laundering techniques, and psychological methods. And we'll cover some of that when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. This hour is being sponsored by Tom Dooley. Yeah, that's his name. He is in Minneapolis, and he does volunteer work at Mayday Books. It's a progressive bookstore. If you're in Minneapolis, it's at 301 Cedar Avenue. No message from Tom, but... he is our sponsor this hour, and if you want to, if you live in Minneapolis, go by the bookstore, Mayday Books, the progressive bookstore. That's where people should buy their books, not online. Seriously, come on. Thanks, Tom. Tom Dooley at Mayday Books in Minneapolis. Last one on the Breitbart. Now I've saved this to the end because I just feel it's fitting. As requested on your website, Mike, to send in thoughts of this man's death, it caused me to stop and then I needed to review what it was he chose to make evident while on this pale blue dot. As a retired hospice nurse, all I could reflect on were the many hours of being present to many deaths, so many I cannot count. But the ones who appeared to need loads of anti-anxiety meds, some even requiring heavy meds, were the ones struggling with issues that had been ignored or negated while having time to process. So it was written, Mike, he died suddenly. I have come to the conclusion, and I align with Socrates, quote, the unexamined life is not worth living, end quote. Humbly, I sit. May I not be considered as a worthless life while being here. Peace, Jude. Good thoughts, Jude. Thank you very much. If you had occasion to be near a television today and C-SPAN or whatever to watch what was going on in the United States Senate, I don't think, God, I get tired of saying this. I don't think I've ever seen anything like this in the United States Senate. But here we are, time being devoted to vote on amendment put up by right-wing, crazy, religious freaks who have no business in the Senate whatsoever in order to allow employers and insurers to opt out of providing birth control to women. I mean, it just, I don't know where we live sometimes. This is not, oh well, why get into the rap? Anyway, the Senate voted 51-48 to kill the amendment. It was that close. It was that close. Almost half of the 99 senators who voted, all the Republican women voted to support Blunt's amendment. Roy Blunt, the Senate Republican minority leader, to support it. Now, the way they framed it was that this amendment was to support religious freedom. And no, it isn't. It has nothing to do with religion of any kind. It was a garbage amendment. It was a filthy teabag, right-wing, neo-fascist, anti-woman, hate-filled amendment. I don't care what they say. You can say anything you want to, you pigs. But it had absolutely nothing to do with your precious little freedom of religion. A religion you would jam down everybody else's throat. You and your freedom of religion, my ass. You have no more interest in freedom of religion than you do in respecting the 52% of the population in this country who are not male. Following the vote today, this pig, Roy Blunt, he's another one. Roy, how's your health? Blunt accused Democrats of playing politics with the issue. This is what you do. This is a part that has frustrated me all these years. They say things like that, and there's nobody to stand up and say, you're a lying son of a bitch, sit down. Nobody does that. He said the following in a statement, quote, I'm truly disappointed by the partisanship that has been injected into this debate on religious freedoms. Religious freedoms. You bastard. You know, you talk about the Christian faith that steals everything to get its hands on from the Jews. This bit about not taking the Lord's name in vain. You know, they don't mean saying God damn. That doesn't mean anything. That's a curse. God damn him. You know, it's a curse. But the way they take their Lord, their own, I mean, it's they claim him. The way they take the name of their putrid religion constantly and use it as a knife, a dagger, a gun, a whip, a hammer, a blunt instrument over and over and over again. Is that how you win souls? Is that how you show your Christ-like love for your fellow human beings? Is this how you do it? Is this how you do it, boys? Huh? Is this how you do it? You try to insert yourself, in a manner of speaking, into the privacy of a woman and her physician. What would be next, you scum, if you can deny women birth control? And why would you want to deny women birth control pills? Why? I mean, religion? In a pig's ass religion. You know that as well as I do. It has nothing to do with religion. Nothing. Is there something in your putrid religion that says that women need to have their menstrual cycles regulated are somehow violating your faith? Is there something that says that women who have hormonal imbalances and need this drug in order to stay in balance, that that's against your religious faith? You lying bastards, you know it isn't. Blunt added that he's going to continue to fight this issue. So he accuses the people who are saying this is madness, this is insanity. Any fourth grader can see this has nothing to do with religious freedom and everything to do with smashing women, smashing them over and over and over again. You will not have the right to control your own body. You are a woman. Adam gave birth to you. It says so right here. You brought all this horror onto the earth by eating the goddamn apple. It's you, you bitches. So we're going to get even. And then this pig Limbaugh, this filthy, filthy pig. Limbaugh called the woman who was denied the right to speak at the contraception hearing a couple of weeks ago a slut. Yesterday, a slut. Sandra Fluke, who's a student at Georgetown Law School. Isn't Georgetown run by Jesuits? Fluke was supposed to be the Democratic witness at a congressional hearing about this contraception policy. Daryl Issa, the committee chair, this right-wing pig, prevented her from speaking. Fluke eventually spoke to a Democratic hearing and talked about the need for birth control for both reproductive reasons and broader medical reasons. She mentioned in particular a friend of hers who needed these pills to prevent the growth of cysts. Limbaugh? Can you imagine if you were her parents, how proud would you be? Your daughter testifies she's having so much sex, she can't afford her own birth control pills, and she wants President Obama to provide them, or the Pope. What does it say about the college co-ed Susan Fluke, who goes before a congressional committee and essentially says that she has to be paid to have sex? What does that make her? Makes her a slut, right? Makes her a prostitute. She wants to be paid to have sex. She's having so much sex she can't afford the contraception. She wants you and me and the taxpayers to pay for her to have sex. Jesus Christ.
It's Mike Malloy.
Past the hour. So Limbaugh feels it's okay to call a college student who attends a Catholic university and goes before a committee to testify and is denied the right to testify simply because the head of that committee, Daryl Issa, is the pig bastard that he is. And then Limbaugh decides to rip this college student to pieces. He calls her a slut and a whore and a prostitute. I hope Sandra Fluke, this Georgetown University law student, will sue this pig for everything he's got. And instead of apologizing for those comments that he made on Thursday, he geared up for round two, according to I think it's Crooks and Liars. Limbaugh said that he would, quote, happily buy Sandra Fluke all the aspirin she wants to put between her knees in lieu of contraception. And then he expanded his offer to the whole university. This is what he said. Quote, a Georgetown co-ed told Nancy Pelosi's hearing that the women in her law school program are having so much sex they're going broke. So you and I should have to pay for their birth control. That's what he said. So what would you call that? I call it what it is. So I'm offering a compromise today. I will buy all the women at Georgetown University as much aspirin but put between their knees as they want. And, of course, he was referencing Rick Santorum's angel, what's his name, Foster Freese, who made the comment about the gals in his day put aspirin between their knees, did a contraception. And then he went on. This is how Limbaugh, you know, the day he dies, I hope I'm still alive. The day he dies, I can't help it. I will take the night off and go out and celebrate because of the poison that this man has pumped into this country for the past almost 30 years. You miserable, rotten, rancid human, you. Then he said this. So, Miss Fluke and the rest of you feminazis, here's the deal. If we are going to pay for your contraceptives and thus pay for you to have sex, we want something. We want you to post the videos online so we can all watch. And to Premier Radio Network that carries this pig, shame on you. Shame on you. Shame on you. To the women who work at Premier, how can you do this? How do you do this? How do you go to work knowing that your network is putting this kind of woman hate all over this country? How do you do it? How do you do it? This son of a bitch who's been married four times and groomed them all. You know what a woman, what you call a woman who marries or hangs out with Rush? A victim. So Limbaugh is now the high priest of the Republicans. You'll notice not a single Republican member of the House or the Senate came out today and said, Rush, put a goddamn cork in it. None of them. Well, I hate to say this, but there was a time in this country not so long ago when a man like Limbaugh, who said the things about this young woman that he said, he would be dead already. This woman's family, the male members. I realize how sexist this is, but this is the way it was. Her father, her brothers, her male cousins, they would have armed themselves and dragged this porker into the street and put bullets all over his body. You realize you know that, don't you? You do know that. There was a time in this country where a man who made comments like that. No, was it a time of overarching sexism? Yes, of course. It was a terrible time, wasn't it? Oh, this and oh, that. You're goddamn right it was. But this kind of stuff, you see, Limbaugh would have been dead meat an hour after he would have said this. To say this on the radio, to take this young woman and rip her to pieces in front of his millions of listeners. A different time, a different place. Limbaugh, you and Andy would have been dancing a jig together tonight in whatever sewer you both wind up. My God. My God. I don't know. I don't know how this happens. Never mind. All right, we have a break. We'll come back and talk about it. See, I just drifted off into that crap again, this time with Limbaugh. Astonishing stuff, huh? The horror of September 11th, 2001...
Limbaugh.
Oh, excuse me. Go ahead.
They say that I'm sleaze and elitist. You please, everybody disagrees with my rap.
It is rap.
I'm horrendous. I'm appalling. My ratings now are falling because I'm so full of bull, so full of crap.
Full of crap.
Condescending cries, making money, selling lies. You might say, everybody hates my guts. I'm offensive, I'm a bigot, I'm a fraud, can you dig it? I'm a sexist, racist, homophobic, fat, pathetic, putz.
I'm a Nazi.
Standing up to the flying monkey right It's Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. This hour is being sponsored by Tom Dooley at Mayday Books in Minneapolis. Go by and buy some books. It's on Cedar Avenue, Mayday Books in Minneapolis. Thanks, Tom. Tom Dooley. Hang down your head, Tom. I know you've heard that a million times, right? The Saudi royal family are business partners with the Bush family and the Murdochs. Matter of fact, outside the family, the biggest shareholder in News Corp, I believe, this is still true, is a Saudi sheikh, part of the royal family, member of the royal family. Keep that in mind. Because two senators in sworn statements who were privy to top secret information on the Saudis' activities now say they believe the Saudi government may have played a direct role in the terrorist attacks in this country on September 11th. Former Senator Bob Graham, Democrat of Florida, said, quote, I am convinced there was a direct line between at least some of the terrorists who carried out the September 11 attacks and the government of Saudi Arabia. He said this in an affidavit filed as part of a lawsuit brought against the Saudi government and other institutions in the country by families of the September 11th victims. Graham led a joint congressional inquiry into the attacks in 2002. This is all reported at the New York Times today. And his former Senate colleague, Bob Kerry of Nebraska, Democrat, who served on the separate 9/11 commission, the Whitewash Commission, said in his sworn statement that, quote, significant questions remain unanswered, end quote, about the role of Saudi institutions. He said, quote, evidence relating to the plausible involvement of Saudi government agents in the September 11 attacks has never been fully pursued, which are weasel words for saying that every indication is that the Saudi government had something to do with this. Now, if the Saudi government had something to do with it, so did the Bush crime family. Now, remember, immediately after the attacks, every single aircraft in the United States was ordered on the ground and to stay there. Nobody could fly anywhere. All of a sudden, boom. Except for special CIA, FBI flights of members of the Saudi royal family and the bin Laden family who were flown out of this country on special 747 jets that flew around the country scooping these people up. Do you remember that? You're not supposed to remember that. That's supposed to go down the memory hole. It's supposed to be gone. No memory of that. Officials at the Saudi embassy in Washington, who have, of course, denied any connection to the attacks in the past, did not respond yesterday to the New York Times request for comment. Now, the Saudis are seeking to have the case dismissed, this particular case, in part because they say American inquiries, including those in which Mr. Graham and Mr. Kerry took part, have essentially exonerated them. A recent court filing by the Saudis prominently cited the 9/11 Commission's, their word, exhaustive final report, which, their words, found no evidence that the Saudi government as an institution or senior Saudi individuals funded, end quote, al-Qaeda. But Kerry and Graham said that the findings should not be seen as an exoneration and that many important questions about the Saudis' role had never been fully examined, partly because their panel simply did not have the time or resources given their wider scope. Oh, do you get this? The worst terrorist attack on U.S. soil since the War of 1812, and there wasn't enough time or money to get the truth. Do you remember that? You're not supposed to remember that either. Do you know how deeply involved in murder and terror the Bush crime family was on U.S. soil? Come on. Come on. Are we to believe? Oh, Jesus, why even get into this? Are we to believe that the Saudis operated totally independently of the Bush crime family as they set up this mass killing on U.S. soil? Huh? Are we to believe that? Yes, we are. Yes, we're to believe the official story. Oh, absolutely. 9 independent or 15 rogue independent, 9 of whom were from Saudi Arabia, whatever the hell the numbers were. We're supposed to forget that, too. Somehow, with no assistance, defeated the most powerful, sophisticated, murderous regime in the history of the human race, and they did it with box cutters? Just walked on the airplanes! Of course. Of course. Terry Strata of New Vernon, New Jersey, whose husband died in the World Trade Center, said it was, quote, so absurd that it's laughable, end quote, for the Saudis to claim that the federal inquiries had exonerated them. Carrie and Graham said the findings of both the commission should not be seen as an exoneration and that many important questions about the Saudis, I just said that, had never been fully examined. No, they haven't. And until such time as the Obama administration or some administration opens up this can of murderous, vicious worms, it will never be examined. Dick Cheney and George Bush should have been put on trial for war crimes. They should have been immediately impeached and then tried in the Senate. And at that trial, the truth would have come out. But no, the people who allowed this to happen, the Bush crime family, were in control. And once they got their co-conspirators out of the country, everything was fine. Don't worry, we'll get you out. You just pull this off. We need this. And the neocons were talking about this in the late 90s. What this country needs is another Pearl Harbor. Completely garbling what really happened to Pearl Harbor anyway. But not to worry. What they meant was, we need something that will focus American hatred someplace so we can bring the hammer down on these dumbass Americans. And they succeeded. But Senators Kerry and Graham, at this late date, where were you boys? Back when you had a chance, back when you had witnesses in front of you. Oh, that's right. The president, the vice president refused to be sworn. Remember that? No, no, you can't swear us in. We're not going to be under oath. No, no. Oh, and by the way, we'll go hand in hand. We'll go together because my dumbass little friend here, Georgie, doesn't know what the hell to answer. I, his Svengali, will answer the questions and he will nod his head up and down, said Mr. Cheney. And by the way, how dare you question the two executives of the United States. Wow. So what do you think is going to happen with this? What do you think will happen now that Kerry and Graham have finally... Remember what I told you, Democrats are cowards. Why didn't you guys bring this up before? Why does it come out in affidavits, in lawsuits brought by the victims' families? Why don't the two of you stand up on your hind legs like men and say to the world, something stinks here? Why don't you do that? Because you're Democrats, right? Because you're corporate Democrats, you don't want to rock the boat. I don't want to rock the boat. So the information lays around in affidavits buried in lawsuits. And the Saudis sit back on their well-padded asses and say, no, no, we've been exonerated. No, 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 nothing there. No, there, there. Nothing, nothing. No, 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 no. These affidavits by these two former senators, which were filed on Friday last and have not been previously disclosed, are part of a, according to Eric Lichtblau at the Times, part of a multi-million dollar lawsuit that has wound its way through federal courts since 2002 An appellate court reversing an earlier decision said in November that foreign nations were not immune to lawsuits, lawsuits under certain terrorism claims. Now, the Obama administration has worked with the Saudi government to try to quash these lawsuits. Huh? You wouldn't think that were the case, would you? I mean, a Democratic president of the United States with his Justice Department trying to get everybody to sit down and shut up? Why? Why would that be the case? Why would that be the case? Why would that be the case?
First, that's why I'm spitting cyanide each and every verse. I see the Carlisle Group and Harris bank accounts. I see them plead the fifth each and every session now. Cause America's been took, it's plain to see. The oldest trick in the book is making enemy. A phony evil so the government can do its dirt and take away your freedom, lock and load, beat and search. Oil, blood, money make these killers ride cold. Suspicious suicide, people dying never told. It's all a part of playing God, so you think we need them while being ash cropped.
Right here. Right now, Mike Malloy.
It's about 9 minutes before the hour. This hour has been sponsored by Tom Dooley. At Mayday Bookstore in Minneapolis, Minnesota, Tom Dooley, thank you, sir. And to your cohorts who work at Mayday Books in Minneapolis, we know that you folks tune into the program, and we are so, so, so grateful. You listen on KTNF. Thanks, Tom. I appreciate it very much. The truth about what happened on September 11th that we, that truth that we, will probably never know about. It'll be like the assassination of Kennedy. Oh, I know. It was, Lee Harvey Oswald. I know. And all the attendant murders and intrigue. It was just coincidence. Nothing there. Move on. I know. I understand. I know a lot of otherwise intelligent people. I mean, super intelligent people who say, oh, come on, Malloy, for Christ's sake, let it be. That's been proved over and over and over again. No, it hasn't. Not to me. No, it hasn't. So the business partners of Rupert Murdoch and the Bush crime family, that would be the Saudi royal family, stand accused of something. Something. Bob Kerry of Nebraska, former Democratic senator. Robert Graham of Florida, former Democratic senator. Both of whom. Well, Graham was the head of the intelligence committee, wasn't he? Didn't Graham lead a congressional inquiry in 2002? I think he was head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, wasn't he? Or was he just a ranking member? Doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. You know, True Seeker, and I know, that the story of 9/11 has not been told. We know this. This is something that's been holding on for over a decade now. And, you know, if you talk about it, you're, oh, you're one of those conspiracy freaks, huh? Oh, okay. You're a truther. We had truthers, and we had birthers, and we had all kinds of errs, right? So the truthers are supposed to be just as loopy as the birthers, right? Not. And again, I mean, I'm expected to believe a lot of stuff by people who claim to be much smarter than me and much better informed than I. I'm supposed to listen to these people and not accept the idea of global climate change. That the planet's heating up. Now, we have tornadoes here in the South now. The Bible Belt. Isn't that interesting? You know, the most religious part just keeps getting slammed and beaten and butchered. People dying over and over and over again. But none of this, that's nothing to do. No. Al Gore's wrong. I'm not supposed to believe climate change because these very wise people tell me, it's just part of a liberal plot. You know, wise people like Rush Limbaugh. And I am supposed to believe that what happened on 9/11, as presented by the Bush crime family and its tacky-ass little committees, investigative committees, I'm supposed to believe that that's the way it did happen. Now, even for you people who accept the conclusions of the 9/11 Commission, that in fact, nine people from Saudi Arabia and a handful more came to this country and with very little effort went through training camps in the United States. That's where all the training took place. You don't believe they learned to fly these commercial jetliners in Afghanistan, do you? Come on. They came here. They did all that. They left a trail a mile wide and 3,000 miles long. Clue after clue after clue. Isn't that interesting? Clues. I wonder who put the clues there. And then these devout Muslims, the night before they struck against the United States, or a week before, they were seen drinking in bars. Well, I guess if you're about to meet Allah, you might as well go ahead and violate the teachings of the Holy Quran, right? Does that make sense to you? So now we have two former senators who are saying that Saudi Arabia may be tied to 9/11. That's the little teeny crack in the wall. Well, they may be tied to 9/11. What? Well, you know, could be, maybe, perhaps, slight possibility. Could be, maybe. How is one slightly tied to 9/11? How? Just keep in mind the one thing to me that was just mind-tearing, that while every aircraft in the United States was ordered to keep its ass on the ground until the Bush crime family said, okay, you can fly again, the Saudi royals, the Saudi royal family, the extended members of the family, and the Bin Laden family were all scooped up, courtesy the CIA, and flown out of the country. Hasn't that ever just kind of flicked at your mind a little bit? Stick around. We'll be right back. 7 past the hour. You have somehow, some way, tuned to the Molloy program. Thanks for doing that. And as we mentioned earlier in the program, the death of Andrew Breitbart at age 43 of a alleged coronary. We don't know for sure. It might have been someone from Acorn who slipped into his room and did something terrible to him. But anyway, I'm reminded of a favorite quotation that my grandmother used to share with me. I don't know if it's biblical or not, but one of her favorite quotations was, "The Lord works in mysterious ways, his wonders to reveal." Let me see here. Another example of what you've heard about, and you've talked about, I've talked about, we have talked about. You know this, I know this, there's some national commentators who know this. The Republican Party has devolved into this cesspool of ugliness, racism, anti-woman attitudes, anti-life attitudes, a kind of toxic, poisonous Christianity that's a mix of evangelical Protestantism and the most rabid forms of Inquisition-style Catholicism. It's taken about 30 or 40 years for this to happen, but it was not all that difficult to see that this would be the ultimate outcome of the Republican Party. Everything they do is an attempt to demonize people who are not part of that toxic mix of poison that they're just spreading all over this country. Now, I'm speaking politically, economically, spiritually, from other aspects. It's a global poison that they're dumping out, environmentally, but just politically. We've talked about this. You've talked about it. Anyone with a brain understands it. Anyone who still has any kind of ability left to think critically tries to avoid getting too close to this Republican Party poison, this right-wing monster that has devoured the Republican Party and sits there burping and waiting for the next thing to devour, like a huge poisonous toad about the size of the Empire State Building, maybe? It's horrible. Some of us have to approach this monster on a regular basis in order to talk about it. Why do we talk about it? Just to make sure that it doesn't continue to do its filth under the cover of someone posing to be a journalist, or someone, some organization posing as a news gathering organization. It's a constant battle. Okay, it doesn't have to be. I'm not saying that it's a constant battle for everybody, but I know it is for me at least 3 hours a day. And it has to be for you if you listen to this program. So the latest in this steaming pile of filth that is the Republican Party, and the right-wingers have infiltrated everything. That was the idea going back to the defeat of Barry Goldwater in 64, the decision to infiltrate or develop, infiltrate academia, business, religion, infiltrate every single social organization in America with this toxic right-wing poison, and then to develop actual oases of this poison that would be scattered all over the country, like Chamber of Commerce that is now nothing more than a right-wing organ. The American Enterprise Institute, National Association of Manufacturers, all these right-wing organizations were set up deliberately and specifically, or enhanced if they already had existed back in the early 60s, enhanced or set up deliberately to undermine any attempt at justice, decency, fair play, equal opportunity. And the language was ripped to pieces. torn into shreds and reconstructed. In the mid-90s, Newt Gingrich added his poison to the reconstruction of political language. I mean, this is not new. It's not new. But its modern genesis has to do with right around 1964 when Barry Goldwater was so utterly and absolutely smashed to the ground. And Goldwater was just, of course, symbolic of the John Birch Society and the right wing, the neo-Nazis in this country. That was their second modern attempt. The first attempt was 30 years earlier against Roosevelt, when they actually had considered armed insurrection and the murder, assassination of Roosevelt. So, where are we now? Here's an example of how poisonous and filthy the right wing in this country really is. And by right wing, I mean conservatism, I mean Republicans, I mean Christian right wingers, Muslim right wingers in this country, Jewish right wingers, all of you, every single one of you. How rancid and rotten you are in this country. Here's the latest example. The Montana's chief U.S. District Judge, Richard Siebel, yesterday admitted to sending, is this euphemistic, a racially charged email about President Barack Obama from his courthouse chambers. Federal property. Federal judge. Right? Now, this was a judge that was put there by Bush. He was nominated by Bush. Confirmed in 2001 by a Republican Congress. Has served as the chief judge for the District of Montana since 2008. The subject line of the email that this pig right-winger, this man who should resign from the bench, he should get his ass off the bench and go, I don't know, go clean urinals in public urinals in bus stations for the next 20 years, you pig. The subject line of the email that he admitted sending from his official courthouse email address on February the 20th at 3:42 in the afternoon, the subject line reads, quote, "A mom's memory." A mom's memory. The mom he's referring to is Barack Obama's mother. This is what the text says. Normally, I don't send or forward a lot of these, but even by my standards, it was a bit touching. I want all of my friends to feel what I felt when I read this. I hope it touches your heart like it did mine. A little boy said to his mother, "Mommy, how come I'm black and you're white?" His mother replied, "Don't even go there, Barack. From what I can remember about that party, you're lucky you don't bark." Jesus Christ Almighty. Barack Obama's mother, according to this filthy, filthy, disgusting white judge, Barack Obama's mother had sex with a dog. There is no downward limit to these swine, is there? To these right wingers. Nothing. No basement.
I hate Republicans, baby, I can't stand those Republicans. I hate that old Republican Party. Their self-esteem is high, they feel no obligation. They put their faith and trust in God and corporations. They stand for piety that doesn't suffer. I hate Republicans. I hate Republicans.
Flying Monkey Free Zone. It's Mike Malloy.
A chief U.S. District Judge, Richard Siebel, in Montana, in Helena, Montana. I'm sorry, Billings, Montana. A nominee of George W. Bush, confirmed by the Senate in 2001, chief judge for the past 4 years. And he sends an email, forwards an email, that says, the subject line is a mom's memory. Isn't that sweet, a mom's memory? And then the text reads, normally I don't send or forward a lot of these, but even by my standards, it was a bit touching. I want all my friends to feel what I felt when I read this. Hope it touches your heart like it did mine. A little boy said to his mother, Mommy, how come I'm black and you're white? His mother replied, don't even go there, Barack. From what I can remember about that party, you're lucky you don't bark. The filthy Republican, right-wing, Limbaugh-loving, disgusting bastard judge admitted yesterday to sending the email to 7 recipients. The judge acknowledged that the content of the email was racist, but he said he doesn't consider himself racist. You son of a bitch. This is in the Great Falls, Montana Tribune. I don't consider myself a racist. I just play in it and wallow in it and smear it on my lard-ass white body and rum it up my nose, into my ears, and stuff in my hair. But I'm not racist. He said the email was intended to be a private communication. Oh, well then, guess what? Guess what, you dumbass? It didn't stay private, did it? Ah? The judge said, quote, it was not intended by me in any way to become public any more than you masturbating to your internet porn was be intended to be public. Right, judge? Any more than dressing up in a diaper and a dog collar and asking your wife to beat you with chains and whips would be meant to become public either. Right, judge? Not that there's anything wrong with that. But your racism, your stinking racism, that wasn't either, was it? Judge. And then he said, the usual, I apologize to anybody who is offended by it, and I can obviously understand why people would be offended. Really? But wasn't that the whole point, you filthy bastard? Wasn't that the whole reason of sending it? So what are you saying here? The sun sets, the sun also rises, water is wet. Is that what you're saying? Then he added, I don't know, if for no other reason, this is impeachment stuff. Of course he won't be impeached. Who's going to impeach him? The Senate? Oh, right. They wouldn't even go after a war criminal president and vice president. If they won't go after war criminals who run the country and are responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people and destruction all over the planet, they're not going to go after some punk-ass little judge out in Montana who forwards a racist piece of tripe. But this is what he said. Quote, the only reason I can explain it to you is that I am not a fan of our president. I see. So when you're not a fan of somebody, the president of the United States, his mother, his father, you filthy bastard. I mean, it is just so disgusting. And then he adds, I didn't send it as racist, although that's what it is. I sent it out because it's anti-Obama. And see, this is where the Republicans really get me. Not only are they lying, sneaking, murderous sons of bitches, but they won't even own up to the fact. Look, if you want to say you're anti-Obama, say that. That's not what this says, Judge. And people wonder why Olympia Snow has decided not to run for the Senate again. We'll be right back.
Radio Right. From the left, it's Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. So, the Chief U.S. District Judge in Montana, Richard Siebel, admitted to sending a filthy comment about the President of the United States and the President's mother and the President's father, insinuating that Barack Obama's mother has sex with dogs, that Barack Obama's father is a dog, that Barack Obama's mother is a whoring party girl who doesn't even remember who she had sex with at the party, that the result of which was the conception of Barack Obama. I mean, this it's just beyond belief. And this guy is a judge? This is a judge. This is someone who makes decisions on a regular basis that involves people's freedom, that involves financial decisions, fraud, corruption, crime, when this rancid bastard is nothing but walking corruption himself. Will he resign from the bench? Will the Senate impeach him? The only reason I can explain to you that I did what I did is that I'm not a fan of the president's. I didn't send it as racist. I sent it out because it's anti-Obama. Never stops, does it? The entire core of the right-wing neo-fascist corporatist movement in this country is racist. Down to its the soles of its filthy, stinking feet. And to suggest otherwise is to be a liar, a fool, or to assume that you are stupid enough to believe it. Any Republican, any conservative, any right-winger who says that at bottom he or she is not a full-blown, snarling racist is a lie. This is what the glorious Republican Party has become. Is Andrew Breitbart still dead? He is? Okay. What did I hear earlier today? He doesn't rise until the third day. I see. Okay. What I hear today from the scum sucker, Glenn Beck, that Glenn Beck is demanding an investigation. You're right. Yeah, I think that's a good idea, Glenn. You'll find out that your boy's heart, he had a heart attack. You'll find out that your boy's heart was just chock-a-block with fish hooks. Palestinian Authority Prime Minister Salam Fayyad yesterday condemned a pre-dawn Israeli raid on two private Palestinian television stations in Ramallah. This was found at TVNewsLies.org this morning in their daily rundown. It's about the only place I've heard of it. Israeli soldiers raided two stations in Ramallah, the base of the Palestinian Authority, reportedly seizing transmitters, broadcast equipment, computers, and personnel files. Oh, I see. Well, why not? I mean, if you declare yourself the occupier, if you move into someone else's little sliver of land and say, get your asses out of here, and then for the next 60 years, pummel and beat and torture and lock up and destroy those people, and suffer the consequences, too, with the occasional suicide bombing and the deaths of your own children as you go about the slaughter of their children. Great civilized actions over there, huh? But if you do all that, you certainly have a right to walk in and close down a couple of television stations. Eh? Prime Minister Salam Fayyad described the raids as, quote, acts of piracy in Ramallah, which is supposed to be under full Palestinian Authority control. Obviously, Israelis don't give a goddamn about that. What, are you kidding me? They probably, on their way in and on their way out, ripped up some olive groves, too. Why not? Fayyad told reporters, quote, these blatant violations seek to undercut whatever authority is left in the hands of the Palestinian Authority, end quote. And he said that he and the Palestinian Authority would help get the two stations back up and resuming transmission as soon as possible. The Israeli army did not tell employees at the stations the reasons for the raid, which, by the way, was the first one in the past decade. You can use your own imagination, which I'm sure is far more rich in vocabulary than the Israeli Defense Ministry, but you can figure out why television stations were destroyed. An Israeli military spokesman said the raid was conducted by the Communications Ministry, not the Defense Ministry. Oh, no. The Communications Ministry. And why? Because the two stations were unlicensed. They didn't have licenses. So let's go in and steal everything. Let's just go in and steal it all. No, let's not get a court order. This is the Democratic Republic of Israel. We are supposed to be a democracy, are we not? But if we want to close a television station, we just walk through the goddamn door and take everything, turn it all off, destroy it, and walk out. Isn't that what you do in a democracy? Eh? The only democracy in the Middle East is how Israel builds itself, and it is built by its apologists in the West. They said that the broadcast interfered with aircraft communications. All of a sudden, after a decade, gotcha. What aircraft communications? The ones that may pass over Palestinian territory on the way to Tehran? Or was that just an excuse? Oh, well, who knows? Who cares? Right? They're just Palestinians. They're not a real people. Who said they're real? Somebody show me Palestine. Har, har, har. There is no such thing, right? You know, I get a lot of emails from American Jews, I assume they're American Jews, who say that to me. You know, Palestine was never a geographical entity. Where do you come off, Mr. Malloy? You atheist communist in talking about Palestine. And I show those emails. You know, I keep them. I keep all this stuff. And I'll show them to some of my Jewish friends, like my daughter's godfather, who happens to be Jewish. And I'll say, Jack, what do you think of this? And he just sits there and shakes his head. What are you going to do? Krugman has the New York Times blog in addition to his column. And he said something yesterday. The title of this little blog is Looking Back with Shrillness. And he references a writer, Brad DeLong, who points out the Republican Party we now see in the primaries has been building for a couple of decades, as we've talked about in this program many times. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand that. You know, it started in 64. It really took off in 1980. This idea of building a Republican Party that was anti-American, anti-life, anti-freedom, anti-woman, anti-so-called minority, anti-indigenous people, anti-every goddamn thing except predatory capitalism. We've lived through it. If you're over the age of 50, 40, you've lived through this. You've watched this happen, as I have. So Krugman says, I can't help thinking of my own decade plus in the journalistic trenches. He's talking about his time as a writer, columnist for the New York Times. And what he had to say is interesting and, I think, to the point. I do pretty much thoroughly subscribe to what Krugman writes about. Whether it is political or economic, I know you have to be careful when you say, oh, I disagree with you, no matter who you're saying that to. But Krugman just happens to be one of those people to whom, given a chance, I would say that. When we come back, I'll tell you what he said. Before the hour. All right, so Krugman. Krugman, writing at his New York Times blog site, is looking back over his 10 years as a writer and what he has been accused, why he's been accused of being shrill, because he tried to point out the corruption and the filth of the Republican Party, like I have, like you have, like a lot of people have, as we have watched the Republican Party just descend into this pit of slime where it is now. But he writes, early on in my tenure at the Times, I felt I had no choice but to point out the inconvenient truth that the official line of the commentariat was all wrong. George W. Bush was not a nice, blunt, honest guy who happened to be a conservative. He was a serial liar pursuing a hardline agenda who, among other things, deliberately misled America into war. For this, I was labeled shrill. More than that, throughout these past 10 plus years, it has been considered ill-mannered and uncouth, not to mention unacceptably partisan, to suggest that the parties, the political parties, aren't symmetric. That, for example, the reluctance of Democrats to cut Social Security and Medicare is not equivalent to the Republican Party's consistent pursuit of huge unfunded tax cuts. That the occasional desire of Democrats to put evidence in a more favorable light is not equivalent to the constant raw dishonesty emanating from the right. And pundits in good standing have been expected to make calls for bipartisanship that involve pretending that Republican politicians are actually the kind of statesmen the party used to contain, but no longer does. So now, we see a primary struggle, Krugman continues, in which the choice is between a series of not Romneys, whose political and policy views are stark, raving mad, on one side, and the not Romney, who is, maybe, just pretending to share those views. How did that happen? The answer is that it happened a long time ago. The GOP isn't just spectacularly unlucky in its menu of candidates. This is what the party has been for decades. Rick Santorum isn't someone out of left field, so to speak. He's always been what you see now. And he was a central figure in his Senate days. All that has happened now is that the mannerisms have finally gotten to the point that the pretense of a reasonable party is no longer sustainable. But you weren't supposed to notice that until just about now. Krugman, writing at his blog site at the Times. He very succinctly, more so than I ever could, points out what we've been talking about on this program for a long, long time, this insistence of equivalence, that somehow if you are involved in journalism, you have to give the psychopaths, the sociopaths, the murderous war criminal sons of bitches equal time with people who are trying to, and losing, find a level of common sense, balance, justice, environmental salvation. Somehow, the people on the so-called left, and those of us on the left, are the ones that apparently have an exclusive franchise on common sense, decency, a sense of justice, harmony, but somehow we have to pretend as though these murderous right-wingers have an equally important message, which is always has been death, destruction, corruption. Well, those are the only three words you need. Death, destruction, corruption. Now, don't you love that term, disaster capitalism? Doesn't that just warm your heart? Doesn't it make you think, well, yeah, okay. At one time, that might have been an operative term. But what does it mean now? It means to go in and destroy a country, destroy its infrastructure, destroy its psychological underpinnings, destroy its monetary system, and then unleash the capitalists to go in and play. No, you're not supposed to speak ill of the dead. I don't know why. When a person's dead, they're dead. What difference does it make? That's not my attempt here. I'm not trying to be a racist. I'm not trying to be anti-decent, or, but I just have one question. Is Andrew Breitbart still dead? He is?
3 days.
I know. It's not until 3 days. We'll ask that question again. What is Thursday?
Sunday.
No, on Saturday. He died Wednesday. Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Okay. So send not for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.